With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Pixels, a podcast for the discerning gamer. Hey everyone, Patrick Beja here for a new episode of Pixels. This is going to be a quick one. I thought I would throw in a quick update before the craziness of E3 starts. We're about a couple of weeks away from that. And that's going to be, of course, as always, fun and insane. And we're going to be covering it live, probably, hopefully, with Scott. I mean, that's the plan. We've been doing that for the past few years. So we will certainly be doing that. And I will put the audio, if I manage to record, from those conferences we're covering live in the feed. People have been telling me that they enjoy that, so you will be able to listen after the fact as well. And of course, after all is said and done, we will do our wrap-up, E3 wrap-up show, our Booksels episode. That will be fun as well. So that's this episode is coming in a little bit before that. And it's coming in after the episode that came just before, Logic. It's the special I just did with Mr. Darling's class. It's a group of wonderful 12-ish year olds whom I had a half an hour long conversation with. If you haven't heard that episode, it's episode 83. Go back and listen to it. It's fascinating. There was a lot of interesting insight. The kids were great. They surprised me a few times, honestly. Their take on their favorite games, depending, you know, not necessarily being the one they're playing the most right now, and their opinion on stuff they buy, virtual items they buy in the games, you know, a bunch of things like that were really interesting. So it was a wonderful, uplifting conversation, I thought. It was really great. So go check that out if you haven't listened to it. But yeah, for this one, it's going to be a quick summary of what's been happening. There isn't a huge amount, but there are some things. And the main thing is the two big yearly franchises, or almost yearly, I guess. Battlefield isn't yearly anymore, but yeah, the big FPSs have given details for the next update, and we have Battlefield on one end and the Call of Duty Black Ops 4 on the other, on both hands, not ends. And then we have the adaptive controller I want to say a few words about, and a few other things. So, you know what? Let's get started with Battlefield 5. I guess you've heard that this game is coming. The release date, I think Battlefield has always been released in October, a little bit before the big November games. But it's funny because it seems everyone is keeping to that schedule of let's release everything before Red Dead Redemption 2, which, if you remember, is coming out October 26th. So anyway, Battlefield is also coming out mid-October, just like every other game this year, it seems. And it's got some interesting stuff, honestly. First, a word about the presentation. Just like Call of Duty, they did a half an hour. It was shorter than Call of Duty, but they did a half an hour reveal, which was hosted by Trevor Noah from The Daily Show. And that gave it, I think, a slightly weird vibe. It was like he seemed genuinely interested in the game, but it felt like kind of a talk show. It was just a bit weird. But aside from that, I mean, the humor and everything was like Trevor Noah felt like he felt obliged to make jokes, because he's a comedian, and some of them were funny, but it just felt a little bit out of place. I'm not sure the formula worked super well. But so yeah, Battlefield 5 comes back to World War II, kind of like Call of Duty last year, and they have a lot of interesting things to offer in that game. There are three main aspects of the game. There is the solo content, which is just like for Battlefield 1, the war stories. So it's basically a series of narrative arcs that are independent from one another, but you play through in different settings from World War II. This is going to be, they're going to add some of those going forward, but you have a number of them in the original game, in the initial game. You'll have also Combined Arms, which is a co-op mode, which is usually a nice place for people who aren't necessarily super fan of multiplayer, and they can still go and have fun with their friends. And then there's the regular multiplayer mode and a Grand Operations mode, which is, you know, if you compare Battlefield to Call of Duty, Call of Duty has always been that, like, easily accessible, super fast, not necessarily very realistic. None of these games are very realistic, but you get my meaning. It's a little bit more arcade-like, and Battlefield is a more gritty, serious, like, if you want to play something a bit more that requires more strategy and thought behind your actions, then you go to Battlefield. And Call of Duty is like, all right, I'll just jump in, run around, shoot someone, die, and repeat. So the Grand Operations are basically a multiplayer mode where it's two armies going one against the other. It's, you know, numerous players on each map on Battlefield. That's another of their staples. And you play through several days, so several maps in sequence. It's about an hour worth of multiplayer gameplay for each Grand Operation. And each day you play, or each map you play, you can influence what's going to happen in the next one. And if you go to the last one, it's really a situation where attrition is super important as a concept. It's important in the game as a whole. You don't necessarily have huge amounts of ammunition and stuff like that, so you have to be deliberate about what you do. But especially in the Grand Operations mode, you're gonna have towards the end, people have used up all of their supplies and ammunitions, and you have to be, it replicates a little bit of that feeling of the end of an operation, a war in a theater of war. So that seems kind of interesting. There are mechanical changes to the game, like you can build fortifications, you can create your own company, meaning you have different soldiers that you're going to accrue and make your team, essentially, for lack of a better word. So overall, it seems like a pretty interesting package. There is solo content, unlike Call of Duty. They talked about the monetization model as well. There's no premium pass, there's no loot boxes, and there's no pay to win. So the only thing that's left, basically, is buying cosmetic items throughout the life of the game. And they've essentially confirmed that that's going to happen. You won't be able to buy loot boxes, so the items won't be in loot boxes. There is no DLC, essentially, so no premium pass, no collector's edition, whatever. Not collector's edition, but no premium pass. And yeah, so the only thing that's left for them to generate revenue throughout the life of the game to add new content, which they will, is going to be to sell cosmetic items. It's probably the preferred model, I would say, for gamers. And I guess they're getting the hint, given that, you know, EA is the publisher and Battlefield 2 happened last year. So they're going to be doing that a little bit more respectfully. So that's good. That's good. So yeah. Overall, I'm intrigued. I'm not traditionally a Battlefield gamer, but if I have time, which is extremely unlikely, I would like to check it out. But so many great games, we'll have to see. A quick word on the ridiculous controversy about the fact that a woman is on the cover of the game. Also, a woman, one of the main characters in the reveal trailer was a woman, and she was obviously very badass because, you know, warrior in World War II, she would be. And it sparked, as you might expect, sadly, it sparked a I don't think very large but visible movement of people saying that this is unrealistic and that you wouldn't have a woman fighting in World War II, which is, you know, let's put aside the fact that this is silly because obviously women fought in World War II when you have many examples of terrifyingly badass women who did incredible things during the war. And so let's put that aside. Let's even put aside the idea that this is part of the silly movement of people who are unhappy with female representation increasing in gaming. Let's even put that aside. Honestly, how insecure do you have to be in your own masculinity to feel threatened by a woman being on the cover of a video game box? That is what really gets me. You know, it's how unsure of yourself do you have to be that you feel this is somehow a threat to your identity? And because at the core of it, that's I guess what it's like, because we're even beyond, I think, movements like, or I guess it's the consequence of movements like Gamergate and stuff like that. But it's, this is so small and silly. And also we can put aside the idea that realism is not necessarily a staple of those games. You have numerous examples of things that happen that, you know, in those games that is obviously, it has no basis in reality. And anyway, so I did want to mention that. And it feels like someone going out on the internet and saying that this is an attack on their identity as men, which I've seen, is, I feel a bit sad for someone that would say this. Because really, okay, you know what I think about all of this. I also do want to mention that I'm not sure there were many people who were saying it. They were being, basically, many of the things I saw were people saying how that was dumb, reacting like that was dumb. And I saw very few people actually saying that you know, women shouldn't be on that, on the covers. So I do think there's a little bit of an effect of very few people are reacting like that, and you will always have idiots who say idiotic things on about any topic because, you know, the internet gives a voice to everyone, and there's always going to be someone who's an ass. And so you're going to hear them. But I wonder if that was really, if there was really an outrage. Although, to be fair, I've also seen that the subreddit for Battlefield had to put a disclaimer for people to read the rules, to not, you know, be disparaging to women, and to stop talking about this, because really it's I come back to that, you know, how insecure do you have to be that this is, you know, she's super badass, she has like this prosthetic arm, which is a claw, essentially, which they did have. You know, it's like people who complain about the historical inaccuracy haven't even looked into the historical accuracy, because it is all pretty historically believable. So anyway, I didn't want to mention it. Let's not spend too much time on it. But rather, let's move on to Call of Duty Black Ops 4. Presentation was super Activision. It was like all dynamic and dude bro for Call of Duty, as always. Maybe that's a mischaracterization, saying dude bro. We haven't seen dude bro since, I guess, Gears of War. But yeah, so what do we get in Call of Duty Black Ops 4? We do not get a single player campaign. Now, whether it is because they didn't have time to finish it, or whether it's because they initially intended to not have one in to focus on other things, we don't know. They're saying they initially didn't want to have it, but it will have a lot of multiplayer to hopefully make up for it. The standard multiplayer mode, which is improved and kind of interesting. One of the mechanical changes they made is that you don't regenerate health by hiding anymore. You have to actively inject yourself with a med syringe, I guess, to regain health. So then the gameplay becomes a choice between shooting and healing, which can be an interesting thing because you have to make the choice. Do I keep shooting that enemy that is almost gone, or do I sort of take a break and maybe let him get away by healing? That could be mechanically interesting. So there's the standard multiplayer mode, which seems quite rich. There's the zombies mode, which has three different sub-modes or sub-maps with a lot of storytelling in it. I mean, they're making it seem like it's a lot, and in the multiplayer there will be as well, which is going to make up for the single player. I don't think it will. It's usually like, let's say, a cutscene you watch once and then you skip through anytime you get to the option and say don't play them. It seems like that would be it. But so the zombies mode is going to be back, and zombies is a co-op mode where you are four people and fight hordes of zombies. And there's going to be multiple maps, so that could be interesting. Blackout is their very much leaked battle royale mode, or suspected battle royale mode, which they didn't give a lot of information about, well, almost no information about. They said there's going to be all of the characters you love from Black Ops games, which I didn't really play any, so okay. And you're going to be playing battle royale. They showed like the 3D hologram of a building that was really tall. That could be an interesting setting for a battle royale. We haven't really seen that. And it's all we saw. We're guessing there's going to be a lot more at E3. That's what I'm expecting anyway. That's what everyone's expecting. And so overall, I would say they made a somewhat compelling package, I think, a compelling presentation. If the battle royale mode is fun, it could be interesting, because I've heard a lot of people say, well, you know, I played Call of Duty single player and that's why I went for it, and so I'm not interested in this one. But everyone who says that follows it up by saying, well, but I haven't played Call of Duty for like 3 years, you know, the last two or three or four haven't really pulled me in. So anyone who is really going to Call of Duty for a single player, I mean, it seems not anyone, but most people aren't really going to Call of Duty at all anymore. So I'm wondering if this, you know, I was saying this on my French show, if you have 5 to 10 hours of fun in each of those modes, and I think you might, you know, five-ish, let's say you do 15 to 20 hours total in those three modes, it might be worth a full price for the game, which it is going to be, obviously. So we'll have to wait and see what the blackout mode is like, the battle royale mode. But bringing this kind of mode to the package and making it a little bit bigger, I really think could work. I mean, it got me a little bit more interested than I had been in the past three or four Call of Duties. So we'll see how it goes. Oh, yeah. And also, it's on PC, it's going to be on Battle.net and not on Steam. So that also rubbed a few people the wrong way. I really don't have a problem with it. I understand why some people think, oh, the Battle.net launcher is a thing for Blizzard games and I don't want it to be sullied by I get it, really I do, but it's a launcher of apps. It's not even like Steam where you have your communities and comments and reviews, and it's really just to launch the things with a little bit of ads on the side. You do have your friends list, but you know, I don't think the Call of Duty players are going to come and dirty and sully your app launcher. So, yeah, I get that it's a little bit upsetting, but I don't get people who were actually upset. So, anyway, it's going to happen, and likely it's going to keep happening. So, we will have to find a way to live with it. And I'm guessing that the people at Activision and Blizzard made a very scientific calculation that no one is going to stop using the Blizzard, the Battle.net launcher because all of a sudden Black Ops 4 appears on it. I guess they are right in that calculation. Another thing I wanted to talk about was the Xbox Adaptive Controller, which is really cool. You know, I've been a bit harsh with Microsoft over the past couple of years, or maybe since the Xbox One launched, and I think deservedly so. But they also have some cool stuff, and the Adaptive Controller is one of those. You've probably heard about it, but just if you don't know the details. It's basically a large rectangular slab of plastic and metal with, you know, it's a controller, and it has a bunch of the option buttons and the directional, the directional key thing, the joypad, and a couple of huge buttons. And it's aimed at disabled gamers, handicapped gamers. And the really important thing is that you have on the back of it 19 jack plugs for each of the 19 buttons from the controller. And for each of them, you can plug in your own button or system to activate the button. So it might be a pedal, it might be a head switch that you can press on with your head, or a straw in which you can blow or inhale through the straw, all those kinds of things. So it will allow disabled gamers to make their own setup in a much, much, much cheaper and easier way than they had to do in the past. The controller itself is about $100, and the issue with those was that they really needed custom setups that were created by you know, associations and communities and groups who would do it differently for every disabled person, disability. And it would be complicated. You had to open an existing controller, solder stuff. And so this is going to make all of it super easy. And they have been working on it for, I don't know, 2 or 3 years. They've been working with disabled gamers associations and disabled gamers. And I mean, it seemed by all accounts, this is just a great move for everyone. There is no cynicism to be had here. And if anything, I'm really hoping that when Microsoft announced this a few days ago, executives at Sony and even Nintendo picked up the phone and called them and said, hey, we want to do that for our machine as well. Would you work with us to make it happen? Because this is a thing that it seems has no downside for everyone. And it's a super cool project for Microsoft. It works on Xbox and PC, by the way. So if you have disabled friends, soon this year they will be able to buy that. And oh, there's also USB ports for the analog sticks. So they will be able to do that this year. It will be released this year. Super cool stuff. A bunch of small tidbits we can discuss. First of all, Detroit Become Human is getting lost in the, I think, E3 hype and, you know, the news from Battlefield and Call of Duty, which are always kind of a tidal wave that washes everything away. But Detroit Become Human is getting pretty well reviewed, a little bit better on Metacritic than Heavy Rain, which was David Cage's previous success. I would say it was better. Beyond Two Souls was not as well rated, but it seems like it's a pretty cool game. I don't think I will have time to play it, but not right now at least. But I'm a bit bummed because I'm too busy for it, but I think it could be one of his, from all I've heard, it could be a more successful realization of that narrative / choices / cinematic gameplay that he's been trying to put together for years now. And it seems like it works. So I'm very curious. I really liked the demo. I might have to try and find some time to play it at some point. So if you like these kinds of games, you might want to take a look at this one. Going to PlayStation, the investors call from last week had an interesting comment in it. It was basically the CEO, I'm gonna forget his name, Kodera, right. He mentioned that the PlayStation 4 is getting into its the end of its life cycle. And those words were scrutinized and interpreted in many, many different ways. Currently, they have sold essentially 80 million units. It seems they're looking at almost, let's say, 17 million more next year. So they will probably be around 100 million when all is said and done. And they also announced 80 million monthly active users on PlayStation Network, with about a third, a little bit more, 34 million paid PlayStation Plus subscribers. So that's a lot of people who pay $60 a year for that service. But getting back to the end of life cycle comment, I think that doesn't mean that we are going to see PlayStation 4 next year, PlayStation 5 next year at all. If anything, it means that the PlayStation 5 is probably a few years away. Probably, I would say, 3. 2021 announcement would make sense. Maybe 2020, with a release 2021 or 2022, it would make sense because, of course, as I've said many times, they don't want to hit the reset button quite yet because they have a huge lead in this generation. At some point, they will have to. And they made a big deal about the services and the fact that they need to have services on the console. And that you can't divorce, you shouldn't, how did they put them, did they put it, you should use those and services to compensate for the dip in operating profit when you launch a new console, because of course at that point it you make very little money on the console you just manufactured, because you're trying to make it, you know, the top of the line type of hardware, so that costs a lot and there's not a lot of profits to be made. Some people took it to, it was a little bit more elaborate than that, the comment, but some people took it to mean, oh, we are going to not have the console, physical consoles anymore, they're going to go to streaming services and stuff like that. I really don't think that's the case. I think we have at least one or two extra generations of consoles, at the very least, PlayStation 5 and Xbox 2, whatever it is, are going to be physical devices. And I think the one after that, but we'll see, you know, that is probably 10 years away, and who knows what's going to happen in those 10 years. But the next one is going to be very much a similar model to what we have now. As I've said, very likely backwards compatible with PlayStation 4 titles. And it might be a little bit more integrated with services that I could see happen, and maybe even, I don't, you know, maybe they're going to try and do what Microsoft tried to do last time and tie everything to your account, including physical copies, but allowing you to sell them easily would be very important, obviously. But we'll see. This is speculation and it's years away anyway. So, but yeah, the PlayStation 4 is entering the last cycle, the last it's the end of its life cycle, and it's been around for already, what, 5 years? If we get two or three more, well, at least three more. And no, by the way, once the PlayStation 5 comes out, the PlayStation 4 isn't out, right? It's not over. So, but it would be 8 years if the PlayStation 5 comes out in 2021, which would be a long life cycle for a console, but the current context would make sense for that. And by the way, the Pro versions, as Xbox One X versions, did not turn into, we might have those Pro/X/whatever versions for the next version as well, but it is really not as big a deal as some people might have thought. when they were announced. Like, we're not going into a bi-yearly renew cycle model like some people thought. That's not happening. So we'll see. And they did mention they didn't. They are not going to be making any hardware announcements, any hardware announcements at E3, which isn't that surprising. They did also mention that they're disappointed by PlayStation VR sales, which I, again, can believe. if that means they're not going to focus as much on PSVR as we might have hoped, I don't know, but I think it's possible. If they're disappointed, if they only have a couple million units in the wild, that's consistent, by the way, with what Oculus said. They were hoping that the market would grow faster, and it hasn't. So PlayStation, you know, VR isn't dead. I don't think that's what it means, but it's a more modest market than what people had hoped or anticipated. I would even say it's not as it hasn't failed as much as things like, you know, 3D TV or motion gaming, because were not approved as bringing something to the core of games by gamers. I think it was more of a side thing for motion gaming and for 3D, you know, for TV viewing experiences. VR has been adopted by many people. It's just that it's not as many people as we, and many people think, yeah, it's cool. It could be cool. It could be cool, but it's not there yet, or it's not there, and motion gaming and 3D were kind of gimmicks. I think PSVR and VR in general is a fun thing that is not as fun as the real thing. So that's a slightly different way of looking at it, I think. Steam Link was rejected by Apple for iOS and tvOS, which is a bummer. It's coming to Android now, so I think it should be released today, I think. And that's really cool for Android users. iPhone and Apple users have to deal with the finicky nature of Apple's approval process. And the reason why they are saying that it's rejected. So basically what happened, Valve submitted it on the 2nd, I believe. They got it approved and they had made the announcement on the 5th. And then Apple came back to them and said, we are actually not going to allow you to have that app on our store. It's the reasoning is a little bit obscure, obviously, but it has to do with business conflicts with app guidelines. I think that means that Apple doesn't want you to have an easy way to play your games that you got cheap on your PC on your Apple TV or iOS device, because then you have less reasons to buy the thing on their platform, which I guess makes sense. But it's also obviously a bummer. I hope that, you know, if someone hadn't approved it in the first place, then Valve wouldn't have made the announcement, and it wouldn't be a semi, you know, it wouldn't be a big deal now, which maybe because it's a big deal, Apple might be rattled into approving it, because after all, it's only a desktop mirroring app kind of thing, and there are many of those, as Valve said on the App Store. But so if someone hadn't approved it initially, it wouldn't have made the news. And so I'm wondering if that someone isn't, you know, the person reviewing the app at Apple isn't a gamer, and they were like, yeah, I know they're probably going to reject it ultimately, but I really want to see this on my Apple device, so I'm going to approve it. I don't know. This is just, you know, me speculating, but I guess we will see. And talking about streaming, EA has bought a cloud gaming company, so everyone is getting ready for that. Obviously, we're not there yet, but Capcom is doing something interesting with that in Japan. They're bringing Resident Evil 7 to the Switch with a cloud edition, quote unquote, which is essentially a rental for 180 days for a cheap-ish price. It's, I think, about $20, something like that. And they stream it. So the really interesting thing is, I've talked about video streaming and game streaming for a long time on this show, and I could see a service in general being something that would be a Netflix of gaming that would work with this technology. But the way Capcom is going about it, and they're not the first ones, I think Phantasy Star 2 is working like that as well, but the way they're doing work going about it is using that technology for a specific game that wouldn't fit on the Switch anyway, graphically, technologically. And obviously you're not going to be playing it when you're, or not easily going to be playing it when you're on in mobile mode, but in on the when you're at home and on the TV, it should work really well. So you only download a 50 meg app, which is, you know, the Resident Evil 7 Cloud Edition on your Switch, and then you just stream the game. If you have a good connection, which in Japan many people do, it can work. So I think it's a really interesting one. And we will have to see how that evolves. But it's even more interesting from the point of view of using the technology for a specific app, for a specific game. I didn't see that coming, and I think it's quite clever. Talking about Japan, Nintendo is releasing a cheaper Switch bundle, which has no dock and no power supply. So it's essentially portable Switch. If you already have a USB-C power supply, then you can get it for cheaper. It's not a lot cheaper. It's like half the amount you save is half the amount you would need to buy a dock in the first place. But in Japan, it makes a little bit of sense because houses are crowded with your whole family. The TV might not be available all the time, and you spend a lot of time in commute. So in Japan, it probably makes sense. I think it makes less sense in the West. And we might see it come with that bundle, but I think we also might not. I think we'll see a sorry. I think we'll see a new version, a new hardware for the Switch in 18 months or so, which might be a Switch Go or portable only version of it before we see that. But who knows? Epic Games is putting up $100 million over the next 12 months for esports in Fortnite. That's kind of crazy. I mean, there are some companies that give prize pools of over 100 million even, but it's things like Dota or I'm guessing League of Legends and like the big established games. Fortnite is very new and putting up 100 million, which is exceptional. It's very rare that you see that much, is kind of incredible. I think Blizzard is putting up like 3 or 4 million for Overwatch esports, so that's amazing. They also said they were going to focus on different things like the joy of playing the game and the community of it for esports, which admittedly a battle royale mode is difficult to get into a narrative for esports. It's difficult to do in esports form because you have 100 people, first of all. Do you get them all in the same arena? It's possible, of course, but it's a very different model. But for watching, even, like, do you watch someone and then they die after 10 minutes and then you switch to someone else, but you haven't seen what they did from the beginning? You could do it, but it's a slightly different approach to esports, which is going to be interesting to see evolve and how they go about it. The people at Epic seem to be pretty clever, though, so I'm sure they will figure it out. And oh, if you like Japan, the Yakuza series is coming to PS4, and there's a demo of the Yakuza 6, which just released in the West, that's available on PlayStation, and that is an interesting thing. You play like for 2 minutes, and there's like an hour and a half of not pre-rendered, but cinematic storytelling things. And it looks good in the beginning. And then you actually start playing the game and you realize, oh, so this is not a like $100 million project. They actually had a AA budget or something like that. But I mean, go check it out. It's an acclaimed series. It's interesting for the Japan-ness of it. And that definitely comes through. And there's an interesting combat system. There's a whole world and interesting characters. Like there's a lot of it that is AAA quality, which makes the AA quality parts of it a little bit more jarring. But it's not to say that it's not it doesn't seem like a good high quality game. So anyway, Yakuza is conquering the West. That's kind of cool. There were a couple of updates. I mean, No Man's Sky is getting a big multiplayer update in July for PlayStation and for the Xbox launch. So it seems like, you know, multiplayer in No Man's Sky, that's crazy. I mean, I don't think most people are going to go back to it. Some people will be interested. I mean, especially on the Xbox, you might want to check that game out because it wasn't available to you until now. But it's weird to think that it's finally getting multiplayer. Like, you will be able to warp to your friends and fly together and do dogfights. And it's 2 years. It took 2 years to finish that game to make it into what was supposed to be. So, that's interesting. We also have an update on Sky of Thieves, Sea of Man, Sea of Thieves, of course, which it's not as substantial, but they have announced that they have like bi-monthly updates for this game. I'm still not sure exactly what those updates bring, but yeah, it's being updated as well. Those two are going to be in the same conversation for years to come, I think. It's very similar how they have been received. A bunch of delays. Shenmue 3 is delayed. Skull and Bones, if you remember, that Ubisoft game is delayed. Those are the pre-E3 delay announcements so that they don't disappoint you for the actual show. So we also have Metro Exodus that is delayed. It looked really good. I think it was in the Microsoft presentation. But we're still going to see some gameplay at E3, so look forward to that. And Borderlands 3 won't be at E3. It wasn't named quite as Borderlands 3, but they keep saying, like, this sequel to a very much loved franchise from Gearbox, and they never name it, but everyone knows it is. But it won't be at E3, which is a little bit of a bummer. At the same time, given that Rage 2 seems to be taking the spot for that, it might not be a bad idea to... I mean, it seems it's probably because it's still cooking, but... I did want to mention about Shenmue 3. It was supposed to come out in 2018. Given how it looks, honestly, it's probably best that it doesn't. Keep working on that game. It's... Anyway. And lastly, super sad bit of news. Total Biscuit has unfortunately passed away. John Bain, if you don't know who he is, he's been a YouTuber and a game critic for a long time, but he got his start talking about World of Warcraft. He was the head of WoW Radio back when we also all, or, I mean, when I got my start in that field, and everyone was starting up, I mean, Scott Johnson, of course, and Terpster, everyone was discovering the world of podcasts through World of Warcraft, and Total Biscuit did as well, and we had a few interactions, and honestly, he was kind of an ass. Admittedly, I met him a few years later, and we had a quick chat, and he basically, he said, yeah, I was kind of an ass back then, which I don't think he ever became not an ass. He became less of an ass. But he was so passionate, and in the end, I think he stood for, you know, for the right things. He got very angry with some members of his community. He was one of those people who was angry, I think, when he was young, and mellowed a little bit as he got a little bit older. And he was just 20, you know, when we, like 20-ish, 21, when we started back in 2006. And not that that excuses anger, but he was an angry person. And he gathered an angry community around him, I think, because he was the guy who would yell and who would say how unacceptable everything was. And over the years, he realized that created a community that was maybe not as fun and cool as he would have liked. And I think because of that, and because he changed himself, he mellowed, as we said, and he was always very passionate. He wouldn't hesitate to say what he thought, but I think he didn't, in the end, in the last few years, the last 5 years maybe, he became that that harsh but fair, if that makes sense, kind of person that I think is ultimately a positive force for the industry. And he was very much beloved, and so we knew he had cancer for a few years, and he was in remission for a while, and it's just you know, it's harsh. As I mentioned, some people are going on Twitter and saying mean things about him and mentioning things that he said that weren't nice. You know, we're not talking about politics or people who, you know, lost their lives because of what he did. We're talking about games. And if you can't be a little bit nice or take a step back when the you know, the poor guy and his family are, I mean, he died of cancer and his family is going through this. And if you have to bring up whatever he said 5 years ago, you're probably not a great person either. So we knew it was coming, and it's not like he was a friend or anything. He's just someone I knew tangentially, and I had been following, and it's just a bit harsh, you know, it's hard. He was 33, and raise a glass to Total Biscuit, and if you have someone you love, tell them. Just tell them. All right, and that's going to be it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. We will be back in a couple of weeks with E3. It'll be fun. Talk to you then. Bye.